Welcome to Frog Ops Food Founders Interview. Today's guest is Amy Mooring of Hunter & Gather Foods. There are lots of reasons I'm excited to talk to Amy. For those who've been following the progress of Hunter & Gather for a while, you'll know that it's a food business with a difference. Truly on a mission to help people cut ultra-processed foods, added sugar, remove mysterious additives from their diet and improve their health. Hunter & Gather is about more than products. Their growth is impressive, as is their brand, online presence and listings, but their commitment to providing help, information and inspiration is really impressive. I'm very much looking forward to hearing all about it. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Well, I guess the first question is, what drove you to start Hunter & Gather Foods? And what is the real food revolution all about?
Yeah, good question. So it's a bit of a lifelong journey, to be honest. So I was diagnosed celiac at 18 months old, which was really young back then. It was before the gluten-free aisles even existed, and it was quite a new thing. So I was fortunate to be diagnosed young, but it meant really understanding the back of pack, because there was no allergens in bold at that time on food. So you had to know what you was eating inside and out. So I was used to scanning ingredients lists and knowing where food came from a very young age. And also I was cooking a lot from scratch when my parents were, and I was used to eating real foods. As I got into my sort of teenage years and I was exploring more kind of food items, and the gluten-free aisles came about, and I just realized how much crap was going into our conventional food. And meeting my partner Jeff, who's the co-founder of Hunter & Gather alongside me, as teenagers, we kind of went on a bit of a journey of discovery together how grains, then refined sugar, and finally seed oils was the final piece of the picture, were impacting our lifestyles and diets. And Jeff was suffering with acne, stomach aches, IBS, brain fog, and we used to call it hangry. So I don't know how many of you know someone, or maybe yourself, that can't go without eating for like 2-3 hours because you're hungry, you can't think of anything else. That was Jeff when we first met as teenagers. And that's not normal. That is not normal. Humans have got such a great system where we should be able to tap into our own fat stores through something like ketosis, which most of us in the modern day have lost that ability. So we're constantly needing sugar because your insulin is going up, down, up, down. So this was really eye-opening for us. Jeff and I completely changed our lifestyles and felt amazing from it. We could blast through our dissertations. We could work 3 different jobs to try and pay for that, all with much more clarity of mind. It was really difficult to find food products in the UK in particular that supported that kind of lifestyle. So we actually created Hunter & Gather to, A, we was our own customer, and we thought there might be some others that might want real food products like us, not actually knowing how many. So it was really organic how it started. And I know you mentioned about the education piece and a lot of the free content that we do, etc. Hunter & Gather was a real vehicle for us, not only to make our own lives easier with products, but also to help educate other people on the journey that we'd gone through. And if you eat a real food lifestyle, there are so many positive benefits out of that. So modern chronic disease that did not exist 60 to 100 years ago, such as type 2 diabetes, obesity, especially in children, it was not heard of. And you can, in most cases, reverse type 2 diabetes and put it into remission through diet and lifestyle alone, saving the NHS and us as taxpayers millions of pounds a year. And we just wanted to educate people on that, that you can take control of your own diet and lifestyle for the better. So that's kind of in a long-winded answer how Hunter & Gather come about, but it was purely organic and over many years of learning, educating ourselves, trying things out, and then finally launching a brand. And alongside that was our own careers that all fed into it as well. So a perfect storm happened.
So I was going to say, you didn't start hunter and gather straight after university. You worked alongside and then presumably quit your job at some point.
Yeah, Jeff and I, fortunate or unfortunate, don't come from the upper echelons of societal hierarchies. So Jeff is from Dagenham, so he's from a council estate. Both our schools are in special measures. We didn't have a safety net of funds. We didn't have any family money to start the business, for example. And I mean, fair play to people that do, that's great. And the majority of startup food businesses in the UK are from those with money behind them, to be honest and straight. We didn't have that. So we came out of university. I have a degree in horses, which is rather random. And Jeff in quantity or building surveying was his degree, and he went into quantity surveying. And we both went down a corporate career path, believing that was like the best thing to do. And again, it didn't take us very long to realize that life wasn't for us, really. I worked, actually ended up in the pet food industry, which really opened my eyes to food manufacturing. So I worked for one of the leading pet food manufacturers and then moved to a grain-free organic pet food company. So from my perspective, ethically, I was going on this journey of conventional wisdom through both our own journeys of food, but also my career of moving into like the pet food being much better for pets. And I worked for a company called Lily's Kitchen, who at the time had started and grown very quickly. And a light bulb moment was, it was my job to educate the buyers in the grocery stores to list the better for you pet food. It wasn't vets, it wasn't governments, and it's exactly the same for human food. So as a nation, we want healthier options in the supermarket, but it's brands that are educating the buyers and showing that there's a desire for this, and no one was doing it. So Lily's was doing it in the pet food industry, but there was no one challenging that convention from human food. So you can now see like how all the dots kind of aligned. And I was really thankful. I was really supported by the founder at Lily's Kitchen, Henrietta, who allowed me to continue working for 3 years at Lily's Kitchen after the launch of Hunter and Gather. And I gradually reduced my time, my split of the week. And that was really great because I knew the mortgage was being paid. I didn't need to take any money from Hunter and Gather initially. And it meant that I wasn't under, Jeff and I weren't under strain, that we had to make quick short-term decisions on Hunter and Gather that would not be of benefit for the long-term mission. So that worked out really well. And I know that we was fortunate in that. But there are a lot of businesses now that are happy to enable flexi working 3 days a week, for example. But yeah, it's not your normal story of have an idea, launch a business, be 100% in. We had to balance our time for the first 2 to 3 years effectively.
Would you say it was useful to do it like that?
We didn't know that there was like big investment and how all that worked when we first started out. As I say, we were just two kids from special measures schools that I flunked my A-levels and had to change to a BTEC, and Jeff flunked his and had to change to something else as well. Like, we didn't know that world at that point. So for us, it was, well, of course you have two jobs because you pay the mortgage, right?
Yeah,
you actually might have three jobs to do what you need to do. My mindset's changed a little bit now, like of a more abundance mindset. Maybe we could have raised money earlier. and gone all in, and we may have grown faster. For us, we wouldn't change that journey because we had resourcefulness. We had to do as much as we could with no money. So Jeff and I built the website, two versions of it. Jeff watched a YouTube video for the first version. I built out our entire sales strategy, and we kept it to two people pretty much and some freelancers until we were turning over nearly £2 million of revenue a year. And we'd done that by an 80-20 principle of you get 80% results from 20% effort. So we kind of were forced into that, whereas some businesses go all in, raise loads of investment, need to continue raising investment, have a big team that they need to pay for, and the sales don't come through and have a sustainable business in the long run. We were profitable early, and that set us up to then be able to scale fast in this last year or two. So we still grew fast in the early days, but it was slower than what we're seeing now. But now we've got the solid foundations that we wouldn't have had if we'd have been all in from the beginning, chasing sales to cover our salaries.
And what's in the range at the moment? And I guess what came first? What sort of products came first and how did that build?
Yeah, so we're a cross-category ancestrally inspired lifestyle brand. So what that means is we take ancestral wisdom for the modern day, and we do that through cross-category products. So we're not pigeonholed. Most food brands you'll see, it'll be like, do one type of product and that's it. That's how it was when we first launched. People thought we were insane to have food products in multiple categories. Because at that time, if you were selling into a grocery account, you'd have one buyer per category. And there's no way you'd want to try and talk to 10 different buyers. But we saw the vision of e-commerce where it doesn't matter. You've got one website or Amazon, for example. A consumer can buy cross-category on the one website. So it takes that away. So we have an interesting range of products from food, condiments in particular. So avocado mayo, which is this one, was our first ever product. Mm. Got it here. And then we span across sauces, oils, dressings. But the principle is, what are the touch points of your daily consumption of nutrition that can be improved through an ancestral approach? So we have daily collagen powders, for example, and MCT oils. So it's all about what you consume. And we see it all as food, but we probably are split into two categories, supplements and your day-to-day food.
So it's sort of very consumer-centric.
The linchpin is the ancestral element. So we want to be able for shoppers to come to our website, or the longer term vision, go into a supermarket and see a panel of hunter and gatherer, and you know everything on that shelf has got real ingredients, free from seed oils, free from grains, free from refined sugars, and is the most healthy option that tastes great as well in that fixture. So, and that could be across everything, snacks, ice cream even, because it is possible to make a healthier ice cream. It could be, condiments. Every single category within the supermarket is ripe for improving in the packaged goods sort of area.
I feel like ultimately you should have your own supermarket.
Yeah, the Hunter and Gather supermarket. One day.
Excellent. and how did, I mean, did you start making yourself, and did you start at home, or did you always use a manufacturer?
Yeah, again, we were so naive, and that's actually, for those that are on here that maybe haven't got a background, naivety can sometimes be a massive strength. And I'd say for us, it was like, we back ourselves in terms of our thought process and our business ability, but like the naivety was strong and good, to be fair, because we were thinking, okay, what's our first product then? There was a few routes we could go. We knew we wanted to be cross-category. We actually worked with FrogHop very, very early on, pre-launch, because we wanted to create a bar at that time, a snacking bar that was, because at that point in time, everything was loaded with sugars. Confectionery was really not good for you. And we wanted to provide an on-the-go healthier option. So we started down that route. And again, like I said to you, we didn't come with any funds behind us, just some credit cards and our own savings. And manufacturing of bars was really expensive. You had to have really big runs, and testing and learning was going to be expensive. And we didn't have the money to do it. So we looked at other products that we were making at home ourselves to fit the lifestyle, and the mayonnaise was one. So we were making it at home. We thought we could scale that up from home relatively easy. It's four ingredients. We started looking at making from home. So we had big mixers. Like one of our friends worked in a school kitchen, and they lent us a big like hand blender, you know, like the soup ones, to do the emulsification of the mayo. But luck be have it, we was Googling, well, Jeff actually found the manufacturer, first of all, Googling condiment manufacturers just to understand how we could learn and do it better ourselves. And we came across a company down in Chichester that was interested in, again, interested to trial something a bit different. And we brought that, and they were initially like, nah, it can't be done. It's four ingredient mayo. So for example, Hellman's has 11, I think, and some even have 13 that are on the shelf of ingredients, stabilizers, thickeners, chemical preservatives, list goes on. We were the first that wanted to do avocado mayo with only avocado oil. So no seed oils, which comes with a complexity because the freezing point is higher. So in terms of stopping the oil freezing in the winter, for example, and then using liquid egg rather than powdered egg, and only preserving with apple cider vinegar and pink salt. That's it. That's the only ingredients we use. Whereas from their world of 30 plus years of making mayo was, oh no, powdered egg, because it's easier. You can store it for ages. You must have some kind of like thickener or emulsifying agent. Oh, I don't think this will work. And you need to have sugar. All mayo has sugar in it. And we was like, nah, we'll just give it a try. Like, we can make it at home. So that's the naivety again, because if you work in an industry that's always done it a certain way, sometimes it needs someone with fresh eyes to come in and be like, why can't you do it this way? We couldn't understand why. So they were really kind to us and let us do a 300 jar initial run, which cost us less than £1,000, which again, credit cards and some savings, we felt like we could manage that. We knew it was in a Salsa accredited facility. They were the professionals with that. So we decided to outsource the manufacturer from day one. We had about, I think, 6 months shelf life on that product initially. It's now 10 months. And we thought if we sell those 300 jars within those 6 months, we'll just place another order and we'll tick it over like that. I think we sold those jars in about 2 weeks. And we kept putting new orders in, and it just grew from that, to be honest.
That's when you know you're onto something, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. The keto, paleo were our niche first audiences. So a lot of people say, oh, you don't want it. Why? You can't have your products that are too niche. But actually having the niche audience at the beginning, if you feel that audience is going to grow over time or can adapt, it's the best thing, because we literally just said like, hey guys, we've created this product that we've been using at home and we follow an ancestral inspired lifestyle. You can't get this anywhere else. we had thousands of people that were just like, oh God, yeah, I work in the city. I haven't got time to sit there making mayo, and it only lasts for 3 days in the fridge unopened, or like or opened. And ours is safety tested, pH tested. We hit a need state that no one else was speaking to, and that really helped grow the business really fast.
What came next then? I mean, you did that for a while, or you then moved on to other products, or?
We love experimenting. Like, again, we're our own, like, we bring out products that basically we want as a team now, but as founders back then, that no one else was doing. So we expanded really quickly. So in the search for the product range as well as the business, so we've now got, I think, about 30 to 40 SKUs now. So we expanded out the flavors, and we did an avocado oil, because in the search for the oil for the mayo, we came across this incredible oil from Kenya, and no one was doing that quality here in the UK. So we wanted to launch that as well. So we had an avocado oil, which was great for cooking, to avoid using seed oils. We had the mayo, and then we expanded into like garlic, chipotle flavors. I'm trying to think the flow of what came next. Then I think it was other oils. So coconut-based MCT oil, really popular within the keto community. And then collagen, so nose to tail. We were trying to encourage people, thinking of all the pain points within the lifestyle is, how can you get protein powder without all the crap that's in it that supports your gut health as well? And that's a big issue with modern kind of illnesses, is poor quality gut health, and collagen really helps with that. It was just product by product. We kind of saw like a need state from ourselves, and then checked in with our consumers. And yeah, just each product that we've launched has generally gone down really, really well, which is exciting.
What's the approach to sales and marketing been? I mean, is it legwork? Have you built a list? What have you tapped into to grow the customer base?
Yeah, so we knew e-commerce was going to be strong for us. And again, this goes back to the point around raising money early and trying to grow really quick. The audience wasn't mass market 5 years ago, so it probably wouldn't have been the right thing to do either. Whereas over the last year or two, ancestral philosophies and lifestyle tips like the Wim Hof cold water, getting out in natural light, like blue light blockers, or those aren't so weird anymore. And they're much more mainstream. Whereas back then it was quite underground movement that was happening. So in terms of like marketing and finding where that consumer was, it's about, where is your consumer and at what point? So we knew if we put in our avocado mayo straight into Tesco, the consumer wouldn't be educated enough or understand why it deserves the price point that it does, because it is considerably more than your basic cheap seed oil.
Industrial.
And that's because seed oils is 15 times, probably actually more now, 15 times cheaper than avocado oil, because of the processing. It's high yield. It's grown in the UK. Obviously, rapeseed oil is the most common, and then it's flushed with hexane chemicals to extract as much as possible out of the seed. It's then bleached, deodorized, and although there's quite a lot of processing behind it, it's quite cheap and there's an abundance of it. Avocados obviously can't be grown in the UK, but we buy the wonky ones that the supermarkets reject. So that's how we can do the product at a good price, but it is more expensive than a highly processed product that's used in powdered egg as well. That's a lot cheaper because they often come from China or Europe, and they're stored for years at a time, versus getting fresh egg and wastage and stuff like that. For us, it was about, where will our consumer initially like find us, where are they? And they were online shopping through Amazon and just D2C in general, and they were actively searching for products and maybe having to buy from the US, for example. So we knew that, so that was where we kind of started out. And then that grew into key retailers. So again, it wasn't about rushing, it was finding the right place at the right time. And we're really fortunate to get a Whole Foods Market listing very early on. So within the first 2 months of launching, we were in Whole Foods Market in London. Prime audience, they were looking for healthier products. The price point wasn't so much an issue in that particular store, and we could do free sampling. So Jeff and I would go into Whole Foods, Kensington and all the others and get feedback. But I would go from my job in the city with Lily's. After work, I'd head over to Kensington and then I'd stand there and sample for an hour or two and then I'd come home. And that was great because we got feedback. We got people tasting the product, and we're actually still to this day Whole Foods Market's number one category leader in that category. And that then showcased that, okay, it does work on shelf as well as online. We then got into Ocado, lots of other independent stockists. And we've gradually over the years just built out, but always done it with a lot of focus. If we go into a retailer, we want it to work for both the retailer and us.
And the website, I mean, obviously there's the e-commerce part of it. There's also quite a lot, loads of content. And there's a really, if anyone hasn't seen this, there's a really great kind of quiz-based tool to help you narrow down the product range to your particular concerns or dietary needs or focus. How did that stuff come about?
Yeah, just little by little. So when COVID first hit, I sat down, I did a whole SEO website improvement course. I looked at loads of websites that I liked across different categories. And again, not being so like pigeonholed into the category that you're working with, like if you're innovating in food or you're the innovator in any category, you don't really want to look at anyone else in your category because they're doing it not as well as what you want to, if that makes sense, because you're trying to be better. So what can you take from other categories and bring into yours? So for us, it was, okay, the US, massive Silicon Valley, tech startups, they were flying in the e-com space. Let's look at some businesses and what they're doing over there. And also what are businesses doing here that we really like that maybe we've seen through social advertising. So we took inspiration from the beauty industry for the quiz. So I've seen a lot of quizzes around what's the perfect shade of foundation for you or which face cream should I have, blah, 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 answer these questions. And I was like, do you know what? We've got so many products now. We'd evolved the range. I think it was probably about 15, 20 products. And for someone that's new to ancestral lifestyles, like, is it going to be overwhelming for them? Because if they need to start doing research, et cetera, let's take that away from them and they can trust in us. They can say what's important to them, maybe the flavors that they like, and we can summarize it down into a couple of products. So you're taking that big, vast 20 products, now for us, nearly 40 products, and going, what am I going to like? And reducing it down into one place. That also helps with newsletter sign-ups so that you get consumers onto your newsletter base so they fill in their email address to get the results. And we can also use those results to tailor our communication to that consumer. So if that consumer has told us, I'm a general healthy lifestyle person, or I'm a hardcore keto or carnivore, we can then tailor marketing to each segment. So we've got a lot more data on our consumers. And really interestingly, as we've grown as a business, like I said to you, we started in a niche. Most of the results on that quiz were people that were following keto or paleo. Now, most of the answers on that quiz are people following a general healthy lifestyle or wanting to improve their lifestyle. And that's because we've seen that true transition as we've grown, and therefore we need to market accordingly to our consumers and where they are in a given time. So we've got a whole host of recipes on the site that you can just control P and it puts it into a printable page for you, really easy. So you can make your own recipe book at home, or you can just view them on the site. These are all free. The reason we do that is, A, it showcases the best way to use the products. It gives back to people that maybe haven't considered how to make healthy swaps, like a Yorkshire pudding, we have a healthy recipe, or a dupe for like a iced coffee that's normally laden with sugar. So that builds trust, credibility with the audience. It gives us talking points to send out via social media, newsletter, and it showcases that you can use our products in so many different ways as well.
I would have been right in thinking you've done a crowdfunding round.
The story goes, end of 2017, we launched the business. I left Lily's Kitchen in 2020. And the year that I left Lily's Kitchen, we were doing already over £1 million of run rate, almost sort of 1.8, I think that year was. And we realised, okay, this could be something big. We could actually impact the health of a lot of people here. But the time is now. We've done 3 years of the niche consumer and getting the foundations, but we were ready to be the face and the name that people could trust, more mass market. And to reach more consumers, we needed some growth capital behind us. So we did a larger investment round, which finished in 2022. We've really, really kicked on with that end of 2021, beginning of 2022. And it takes quite a long time to go through that raising process whilst also trying to build a team, run a business. So it's not for the faint-hearted to do that. It's not an easy process. So we raised about 1.7 million in that year. And because we were already, we'd grown quite a lot. So the 1.8 million jumped to 2.8 million in the next year, and then just under 4 million in the 2022 year. We didn't have to give as much away of our business than if we had raised really early. So Jeff and I are the only significant shareholders within the business still, and we have a very small board, Jeff and I and one other. So we've still got massive control over the business because we waited till later. And part of that round, it was really important for us to enable our consumers the chance to invest within the business. They get so much say in what we do already, from the reviews that we read to our Facebook group. Most of the people in the Facebook group have been with us since the beginning, and they actively tell us what new products to launch or what improvements to make, and we listen. We poll our Facebook group all the time as well with like, what do you think of this? What would you want? And they really guide the business. So we really wanted to give them the opportunity to invest and actually feel massively part of it. So we ran a Seeders crowdfund campaign alongside larger investors. So it was a mix of individual angel type investors and then our consumer. And you could invest from, I think it was £11, £12. You could become an investor. So really accessible for everyone. And we welcomed a good few hundred people into being a hunter and gatherer investor.
Yes, I saw them name checked on the website. It's a nice touch, I thought.
Yeah. So we've got, if you invested over a certain amount, you got a block on the website as well with your name. And there were other perks. Also, all of our VIP investors and subscription shoppers on the website get day early access to any new products, as well as discounts and other things. And we're building out the what it means to be in the tribe more this year as well. But we really look after our subscription and VIP shoppers. And that we've got a really high repeat purchase rate as a brand. Shoppers that shop into us generally come back time and time and time again. Once you peek behind that curtain, going from conventional health to what it could be, it's so hard to go back because your mind has been opened, especially when there's no compromise. Most people say our mayo tastes better. A lot of our products taste better than the unhealthy or other options. So they stick around.
That's great. What are the main kind of plans for the next few years? What are your big objectives?
The mission, as I said, is just to be everywhere that a health-conscious consumer shops. So we're expanding our retail presence this year. So we are launching into, I can now announce it because it's actually been shared. We're launching into Tesco's in April. So very shortly, which is our first major grocer listing in the UK. So we're going into really excitingly as well, they're launching us onto what they call Power Aisle One in a certain number of stores, which is normally where you see like Easter eggs and all the really like Mother's Day stuff, and they're doing a big innovation panel. So keep an eye out in big Tesco's from April, middle of April, which for me is so exciting because it's taken away from confectionery and really heavily sugary, poor quality ingredient foods to nutrient dense and giving us an opportunity to shine. So that's really exciting for us. And that's leading conversations then for other retailers, because Tesco are the leading grocer still at the moment. We're also expanding internationally. So we're launching our website for European customers, because we now have a warehouse in Europe. So we can ship from Europe to Europe, which is very exciting. And we have launched a small selection of products in Amazon US.
Was this sort of tester?
Yeah, so a test and learn. It's really easy for us to run it here from the UK. And going into Amazon means we can send product from the UK and sell in America. So it's a test and learn just to see what we can do. And then there's potential in the future for expansion into retail and in the US as well.
That's really exciting. Are there any things you wish you could go back and tell yourself back in 2017? Anything you've learned along the way that would have been really useful to know when you started?
Trust your gut always. Like, my gut has got me out of so many situations that could have happened, and that is my strength, and I think Jeff's strength as well. We're not very good at anything in particular. We're not a specialist in SEO. We're generalists, and that's actually great sometimes because you can have an overview of the business. I'd also say change becomes your friend. Don't be scared of that, because if you're in a really fast-paced business, so for example, this year we're expecting to grow nearly 100%, and we did 80% last year. So in 2 years, the business has completely changed. So this year, the end of this year, the business will be twice as big as it was the year before. And it was nearly twice the size then of the year before that. So if you think of that pace of how you have to scale everything up, from team to infrastructure to everything, just doubles. Imagine just doubling everything year after year. It's really quick change, and you have to get comfortable with that and be almost 6 months to a year ahead in your mind and continually change and review everything and refresh. So we actually reforecast and replan everything every 3 months, because we're moving so fast and we have to keep ahead of it, which is really exciting. But also terrifying.
Don't look down, whatever you do.
Terrifying. And what I didn't anticipate, and I try and encourage and share to other founders, like, the journey is fun. We embrace the journey. It's one of our like maxims that we talk about here. It is a journey. You have different things that come along any given day that you couldn't even imagine like happening, no matter how much you try and cover things off. Like, we've gone through COVID, we've gone through recession, we've gone through all within really early days. And I think not thinking it's a guaranteed, like, I have a little, both Jeff and I have a little edge about us that we really take it, we don't take it for granted. And I think telling myself that having that grit from my background and Jeff's background is going to be an asset, and don't feel inferior to those that have already trodden a path on their third business or whatever, because your naivety, your grit, your determination and trusting of yourself and your gut will see you through. I'd probably also tell myself that mortgage companies on houses are tricky as if you're a director or founder, which is one, is a bit of a curveball. Everyone's like, what? Again, paying myself from Lily's Kitchen and not taking a salary out of Hunter and Gabler very nearly bit me in the ass, because from my perspective, that's a really clever thing to do, because you're paying your mortgage because you've got another business. As soon as you leave other business, the mortgage company only at this time, this was about 2-3 years ago, a couple of years ago now, but I believe it's still the same, they will only judge your income from your directorship business. Therefore, I think I'd earn 10 grand per year on average, it worked out, from the company, because they wanted 3 or 4 years salary. So so if you're going to start a business, lock in a mortgage for like 5 years. That's my top tip if you've got a property that you're buying.
Believe me, that hasn't come up before, but I think it's a really good one. I've got some questions. Yvonne asks, where does the majority of Hunter and Gather's online sales come from? Which platform?
Yeah, so 80% of our sales are classed as e-commerce, and it's roughly day in, day out. It fluctuates a little bit, but around 40% of that is our website, and we're on a platform, Shopify, which most of you probably know, and the other 40% is Amazon.
Excellent. And she also asks, what are your thoughts on wholesale versus online?
So wholesale, I used to be a key account manager for wholesale at Lily's Kitchen when I first started out. So I saw a place for wholesale. So mistakes that I learned at Lily's Kitchen were, you could try and control it all and get direct sales to each independent shop, and there's thousands in the UK, but you're going to need a team to place those orders, input them, becomes really costly, nightmare for customer service. So are there ways that we could have improved that? So when we first launched, we knew that we wanted to work with wholesalers. They take out a lot of the pain of delivering to lots of independents. They do hit your margin slightly, but if you can't fulfill wholesale orders, you won't have the money to do D2C.
Yeah.
So a lot of people think, oh, I'll never do wholesale, the margins. If you look at the full P&L versus just COGS and sale price, if you take into account logistics, marketing spend, packaging, etc., D2C, it is slightly more profitable than wholesale, but not massively so. And they take out a lot of the pain of individual delivering. What we do also is we only work with a couple of key wholesalers. So CLF is one. Give me the thumbs up again, who manage our relationship with stock fulfilling to Whole Foods Market. And we also work with Dundas, who used to be Tree of Life, similar people. And then I think we've got 2 or 3 international wholesalers as well. So I'd say don't have too many, because you need to support them with marketing and adverts, etc. They're a bit of a pay to play type place sometimes. And then we also have a B2B portal connected via Shopify. You can get Shopify one. We just have it run through the website, where it's a trade ordering portal. So we do have independents that come direct to us and they place their own orders. So it takes out a lot of the manual input from sales teams.
Jonathan from Gymfluencers asks, are we going to see you take on the protein powder market with real quality ingredients, no badness? Doing it the H&G way would be great.
So possibly. There's some really great options with like bone broths and beef proteins. A lot of protein powders out there use bulkers, fillers. There's a lot of whey protein from non-grass-fed animals, for example. So there's definite opportunity there. It's going to take a lot of development, but possibly. No category is safe from being hunter and gatherer.
One final question, if that's okay. What is the main and most successful marketing channels you use?
There's no silver bullet is what I'd say. And it's all, I envisage it more like a cog. So there's not just one that you necessarily can do on its own. You need to have a flywheel of marketing. For us, we spend most of our money on social right now. Being an e-commerce business, we can see a direct link from how much we're spending. So we can track our customer acquisition costs, we can track our lifetime value, and then we know if we put X amount of money into social, we know what we're getting out. So it's really great from an early stage, and you can scale that up and spend more, spend less, pull it back. We're now entering the world of retailer marketing and more guerrilla marketing type things, influencers. But again, no silver bullet. It's just gradually build up. But there is still money to be made in social, in our opinion. A lot of people say it's really expensive, but if you get your average order value at a good level, the margin of your products at a good level, then you can still make it work. One last question I just want to cover off because it's a good one that was in the chat. Where the origination of the Hunter and Gather name came from. So it harps back to ancestral, but it's also my grandparents are Hunts and Jeffs are Gather Goods. So it's actually names. So that's why it's not Hunter and Gatherer. It's Hunter and Gather because it's a nod to our own ancestral heritage.
Brilliant. It's just layers upon layers. Fabulous. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. And thank you, Amy, for that. That was absolutely, I think there was just so much great advice and experience in there. I think everyone who hears that will really benefit. If you want to find out more, check out that quiz and all the great content and buy online, of course. You can go to hunterandgatherfoods.com. If you want to listen to some other Food Pandas interviews for inspiration, go to froghop.co.uk/podcast or search for Food Founders Interviews wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again, Amy. That was brilliant. Thank you so much. And I look forward to doubling a few more times and going to that Hunter and Gather supermarket as well.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. If anyone wants to follow me on LinkedIn, I share a lot about the business journey. So I'm Amy Mooring on LinkedIn. Check us out there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. See you guys.